most Americans recognize the name George Washington, or John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison. But few can tell you their stories, much less that of James Monroe, John Quincy Adams, or Andrew Jackson. These seven men from the founding era were America's first presidents. They established our republic on the foundation of the Constitution and its liberties. But who were they? Were they good or bad leaders? How did they become presidents? Did they follow the Constitution or abandon its principles? We've invited our friend Tim Barton, president of Wall Builders, back to the Economic War Room to help us learn the bad, good, and beautiful from our founding presidents. And what I quoted, that's from his new book that's out, The American Story, Building the Republic. Welcome back, Tim.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Hey, tell us about the first seven presidents. What kind of men were they? These were men who built the republic.
Yeah, so really it is a wide spectrum of them. I mean, it's like reading the Old Testament of the Bible, right? Where you're going to have some really great kings of Israel and some really bad kings of Israel. And as you kind of alluded to in the introduction, the point we try to help remind people, a lot of times we think because we're very familiar with their names, we know who they are. But really, if we're like, tell me a story about James Madison, and someone says, well, he wrote the Constitution. And I would point out, well, that's a fact. That's not a story, right? We don't really know their stories. And therefore, we don't know the lessons we should be learning from history, examples that we actually could look at modern day and think, we could have known from 200 years ago examples that we should never do what's happening right now. Now, we also can look practically common sense and think we shouldn't be doing what we're doing right now. But we wanted to go back and show the people that started the nation. When you go to the American founding beginning, Declaration, Constitution, kind of the illusion is that this is the founding fathers building the nation, or in some sense, like building the boat.
Right.
The first seven presidents are the ones that put it on the ocean, and they direct the trajectory of the nation. And some of them did a really good job, whether it be a George Washington, a Thomas Jefferson, a John Quincy Adams, and then some of them, like a James Monroe or Andrew Jackson, did devastating things. Andrew Jackson single-handedly changed the entire political structure, weaponizing politics, weaponizing the U.S. government against his political opponents, and he changed the foundation from what George Washington did. Modern politics today is a greater reflection of Andrew Jackson than any other president. With all of the negatives, all of the detrimental things that have happened, Andrew Jackson was the one that set that precedent. And we go through the book reintroducing people to some of the heroes. We should celebrate the contributions of a George Washington, a John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, but then we should be honest about some of the things like a James Monroe. What did he do and how did he do it? Well, he was the one, the first president that allowed pro-slavery states to join the Union, because this was something the founding fathers said, okay, we're going to allow the southern states for 20 years to maintain, we're not passing laws according to the Constitution, for 20 years to deal with the importing of slaves, but 20 years, we're going to revisit this conversation. James Monroe was the president, not Madison, not Jefferson, Adams, or Washington. James Monroe said, no, we should have more slavery in America. He's the one that started that. Well, John Quincy Adams, famous anti-slavery abolition leader, he comes and says, that's a terrible idea, right? He dedicates his entire life to fighting slavery. But then you have Andrew Jackson who comes, and he continues that James Madison turns the ship in the wrong direction. John Quincy Adams tries to straighten it, and Andrew Jackson just like full on 180 turns that thing the wrong direction. So we really try to go through, reintroduce people to who they were, learning their stories, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and then the practical lessons we can learn for today.
Yeah, well, Andrew Jackson, growing up in my household, you know, Cherokee ancestry, he was the president who shall not be named.
Yeah.
I mean, he was the most hated president. Now, I was just in Jekyll Island, Georgia, and we went to where the Federal Reserve started, and, you know, that's a modern central bank that we deal with. It's not a national bank. It's a private bank. But when I was there, I thought one good thing Jackson did was he did end the central bank.
Yes.
And it's ironic that his picture's on the $20 bill. But other than that, I have nothing good to say about the man. But, you know, we often deify the early leaders, mm-hmm. or we turn them into absolute devils, like my family did with Jackson. But these were human beings.
They were.
Real men who had vocations. And they weren't all just attorneys that had been governor at once.
Right. Well, and the reason we even chose the first seven presidents is because all seven, from George Washington to Andrew Jackson, all seven fought in the American Revolution. So all seven knew what America was supposed to be about. They knew what the birth of the Republic was, what we were trying to accomplish. And so they would have had the best perspective, in theory, to know what direction America should go. And to your point with Andrew Jackson did more damaging, detrimental things to America, probably arguably more than any other president. But if you back up, he's an incredible military leader for a lot of years with the War of 1812. And he did some really good things. But then when he got to be president, one of the things, he was a senator from Tennessee before he was president. And as senator, he actually was telling people that were encouraging him to run for president. And he said, guys, I am not fit to be president. This is his own explanation. He says, I'm not fit to be president. He says, I am fit to lead hard men into battle where bad things happen.
But then you just said he weaponized the administration. He took his general attitude and we've got to win this war, and he weaponized it against the Americans.
That's exactly what happened. And this was the point. He said, I'm a good general where I can fight and defeat and conquer an enemy. He said, but I'm really not good at working in political. Well, when he runs for president, it's exactly what he does. He views his political opponent as an enemy to be crushed, to be destroyed, and he weaponized the government against his political enemies, what we see today.
Yeah.
That is what Andrew Jackson started, because that's not what George Washington did. It's not what John Adams or Jefferson or Madison or Monroe or John Quincy Adams did. Jackson was the military general who viewed any challenger as someone to be destroyed instead of what's best for America. He said, no, how can I win this war? Well, that's not what's best for America, whereas arguably every president before him at least had the consideration of what's best for America. Andrew Jackson, as a president, didn't have that same consideration.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Andrew Jackson, isn't he considered the founder of the Democratic Party?
Absolutely he is. It's interesting, the founder of the Democrat Party being a racist, pro-slavery, weaponizing federal government. It's interesting.
Yeah, no,
no correlation to Democrats today. Just coincidence.
Except maybe a few years later with Wilson and others.
But I mean, it looks pretty similar.
Yeah, it does look pretty similar. Well, and he was a contemporary of Sam Houston, which is considered the founder of Texas.
Yes.
So there's a lot of interesting stories with Andrew Jackson. We're going to need to take a break. When we come back, let's dive a little further and see what other lessons we can learn from these shapers of our republic. We're talking with Tim Barton. He's got a new book out with his father, David Barton, The American Story, Building the Republic. And it tells the first seven presidents, and these are real men. But what can we learn from those founding presidents?
Well, one of the things that we point out, George Washington is known as the father of America, also known as the indispensable man, and quite arguably so. Had it not been for George Washington, questionable if we win the American Revolution. Had it not been for George Washington, the Constitutional Convention probably would have fallen apart because he was a president. Had it not been for George Washington, which also you can back up, even at the end of the Revolution, he helps win the Revolution, and then his generals want him to become the king of America, right? He turns that down. More than one occasion, people wanted him just to take over because they thought Congress was inept, and we don't trust all these other people. We know and love you, George Washington.
Right.
So he helps get through the Constitutional Convention when it's falling apart. So without him, there's no Constitution. And then he becomes president, and he set the example for what a president should be. There were no term limits. And he set the example. He said, really, nobody should serve more than two terms because then it would be like they were being a king. And no other president did except for FDR, and he was and arguably in some ways trying to become a king of America back in the World War II era. But George Washington showed what a peaceful transfer of power looked like when nobody really in the world had seen that at that time. So George Washington is incredible, but in George Washington's cabinet, he has all these other founding fathers that are there, and there are some major problems happening during George Washington's administration. Part of it, England and France are in the midst of some of their many, many wars. Right, France is going through their revolution, and Washington's cabinet is really split over, are we team England or are we team France?
Yeah.
And even this is where John Adams and Thomas Jefferson have their falling out, because up to this point, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, they were in the committee together drafting the Declaration. They are friends. They're allies in this. And then Under Washington administration, they have a major split falling out over some of these issues.
And Washington, France, Adams, England.
Correct. And Washington, as he's seeing all of this unfold, it's interesting, when you look at his farewell address, he wasn't writing his farewell address as some theoretical advice to the nation. Everything in his farewell address is what he was seeing the members of his own cabinet having these issues. So when he says, don't be distracted by foreign entanglements, let's focus on our nation right now, right?
Yeah.
I mean, all these, they're so practical. And the reason I even bring this up is his farewell address, the most significant political address ever given, has the most practical advice for us today as a nation, because we can look at what we're doing. We've sent more than $200 billion to Ukraine with no accountability. Like, what are we doing? We're not protecting our southern border, but we're sending money to all these other nations around the world. We're sending money to fund the UN that hates us, that doesn't support us, that is anti-American values. George Washington, literally his advice was, yeah, let's not spend as much time with things out there. Let's focus on America. Well, he starts going through in his farewell address, and he probably gives maybe 12 different pieces of advice, approximately.
Yeah.
But he talks about avoid party over principle. Don't support a political movement more than the principle of the nation. Well, we live in an era today where it is exactly about my party winning more than the principle. And we actually talked even before the show where we've seen politically that it used to be a time where you might have somebody in a political party say, well, I don't support this position. But then when it came down to it, they voted to support their party, even though they knew it was wrong in that issue. We have come to the place where in our modern culture, it's become more important that somebody's side wins than what the principle actually is. That the principle of life, or the value of life, that marriage and gender and
or property or any of a number
correct.
Of other things.
Which we can go even further, because George Washington talked about that we should avoid debt under all circumstances. Don't allow the nation to go into debt. And here we are, trillions upon trillions and trillions of dollars in debt. And as he goes through, which, yeah, you've got so many good pieces of collection regarding that.
Yeah, no, this is a Continental note, and he said that a wagon full of Continentals would not buy a wagon load of supplies because it was supposed to be backed up by 4 Spanish mill dollars or the value thereof in gold and silver. This is printed in Philadelphia. Reason Washington's troops didn't have shoes at Valley Forge is because there was no money behind the money.
Right.
And they hated paper money.
And going back to the adage, it wasn't worth a Continental.
Yes.
That's a Continental, and it was worth nothing.
Which is why I own it from eBay. I can buy it. You can buy them now, like buying Confederate money or picking up Zimbabwe notes, you know, $100 trillion Zimbabwe notes. So, yes. And was Washington as humble as he seems? Because he seems like the most humble, except for maybe John Quincy Adams, who is also incredibly humble.
Yeah, so what... My dad and I would refer to John Quincy Adams as George Washington Jr. So similar in their values. And when you look at their lives, just as an example, it's really hard to find any major failings and character flaws. Now, because they're human, right, a faith perspective, we know that all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, that there is none righteous, no, not one. So we would not by any means argue that, right, these were Jesus-like figures. No, right. Of course they weren't. They were humans. They weren't perfect. But when you look at their overall life, it is remarkable what they did, and especially measuring in the context of the time in which they lived, how they lived their life. They were incredible leaders. But I want to go back. That one of the pieces of advice that George Washington gave, that in the midst of so many other great pieces of advice in the farewell address, he said, of all of the habits and dispositions which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are the indispensable support. So he says, of everything I'm telling you that's going to make America significant, the indispensable supports, the one thing you can't do this without, is religion and morality. And they were so clear in the founding era that religion was Christianity and morality was the principles of the Bible, right? That's where you learn morality. And so they're very clear that America cannot function without Christianity and without the Bible, because the founder's idea was to give freedom to the American people, but freedom only works if you have a moral people, and you only have a moral people if they're people that have been schooled and trained in the Bible and Christianity, which of course the majority of Americans were. But when you begin to look at his advice, what's so interesting is, again, he's not writing a theoretical concept.
Right.
He's writing specific advice to John Adams, to Thomas Jefferson, to James Madison, like, guys, Just think about these things a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's interesting as we go through the seven presidents, a lot of their rise and fall, their successes and failures really hinged on how well they followed the advice George Washington gave. Because George Washington, he's really a friend, an ally to them, but he's almost like a father figure. And it's a father giving advice to his kids,
yeah,
right? He's like, hey, guys, here's this advice, right? I'm just going to encourage you to follow this. And it's just so fascinating as we go through and tell their stories to see their successes and failures based on how well they followed the brilliant advice of George Washington.
You know, I think of the French Revolution going on about the same time as the American Revolution. One was God-centered, the other was godless.
Right.
And you can see the outcomes.
Yes.
From the disparate systems, and Washington was right. Liberty only works in the context of Christ, where
right,
you have an overarching authority, God. That we're going to take another break. When we come back, we'll dive further into these first seven presidents. Tim, going through the first seven presidents, if they were alive today, could be magically brought here, what advice would they give to a President Biden or a President Trump?
Oh, man. That's an interesting question, because I would also think, what advice would they give to the American people? And I think probably, and it might be very similar to a Biden or a Trump, but I think they would look at Biden and they might call him King George the Fourth, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so fascinating. If you go back and read the Declaration and all of the reasons they thought we should separate from the King of England, it's what we're doing in America right now. Everything our federal government is doing are the things that they said we recognize what the rights are that God gave. That there's a divine creator, and he gave rights,
right,
to man, and government shall protect those rights. And they start listing all the ways the king was violating those rights. And if we look at what the federal government is doing in violating our rights according to what the founding fathers understood our God-given rights, and they even acknowledged that there was a laws of nature, nature's God, that there was a fixed moral code and standard, and we are seeing that violated in so many respects. But where I think it's such a difference in America as opposed to King George, I don't think they would say, we need another American Revolution, because they would look and go, wait a second. You mean you were voting for some of these people?
Yeah.
You were choosing some of these people? I think they would encourage our leaders to understand their position, that they outline in the Declaration that to secure these rights, governments exist among men. The reason our government exists is to protect and defend our God-given rights, which really goes back to a biblical perspective. The Bible outlines government exists to reward the righteous and punish the wicked. The number one thing government does. Well, the government also exists to protect their people, which if you go back and read and study your Bible, one of the very common things from the Bible, in fact, where wall builders gets the name wall builders, the story of Nehemiah, how do they protect people? They built walls at times to protect the people,
yeah,
that lived in their land. Walls are not an unbiblical thought. In fact, it's one of the most biblical thoughts that a government can do to protect their people. And if we start looking, what is the ultimate role of the federal government? It's not to run our lives. It's to protect our God-given rights, to allow us the freedom, the opportunity to live a life according to what God has called us to do. So I think the advice they would give to the president is to recognize your role. Also understanding the Constitution, it gave a specific listed out powers,
right,
of what the federal government, what the president can do, of what Congress can do. And they would remind them, right? You can only do these things outlined in the Constitution, and you're trying all these others. That's not how that works.
Well, here's the difference. I can't speak for President Biden. I've never had a chance to meet him. I've never had a conversation. But his supporters decry the notion that God has given us rights.
Right.
And so government can't violate rights if government gives you rights.
Right.
It's impossible for,
right,
them to violate them. And it's impossible for government to be limited, like you just said. You know, people ask me, can the federal government print unbacked currency? And the founders all hated paper. Jefferson said, paper is poverty. It's the ghost of money, not money itself. Washington said, paper money will have the effect in your state that it has always had, which is to ruin commerce. That's what he said. So why do we print unbacked paper money? Well, the reason is the founders, the Constitution, was not written to prohibit the federal government from emitting bills of credit. They prohibited the states. And I've read the debates. The reason for the debate was, well, we don't have to prohibit it. We didn't give them the right to do it. Therefore, it doesn't have to be prohibited. Why should Governor,
right,
Morris stood up against paper money and convince them. And they said, well, do we have to prohibit the federal government? No, of course not. It's not been given to them as an authority.
And Jefferson was so brilliant on this. So he's interesting where Washington and Adams did things. Jefferson actually became a very strong opponent toward the end of his presidency, or not his presidency, toward the end of Washington's presidency. He was still serving under Washington. He became a strong opponent of George Washington. Said, I don't support what you're doing because you are doing things the Constitution didn't say you could do. Well, the Constitution, I mean, right, and this is where I would argue, okay, I think there's some allowances for what you can do. But to Jefferson's point, Jefferson said the president can only do the specific things Constitution says he can do. And so even, for example, Washington, and this is a silly example, but it's very accurate to what Jefferson thought and believed, Washington and Adams both did presidential prayer proclamations calling on the nation to pray. Thomas Jefferson did prayer proclamations when he was governor of Virginia.
Right.
But when he was president, Congress called on him and said, hey, we want to do another day of prayer and fasting. He said, president can't do that. Constitution doesn't give me the authority to do that. And they're going, wait a second.
Yeah.
Right? Like Washington, Adams, we've done that. And he says, you're only supposed to do as president what the Constitution says. But this goes back to your point. The idea was the Constitution lays out what you can do. It's not a limitation of what you can't do saying, right, well, if we didn't want you to do it, we were told you. No. They listed the outline. These are the only things you can do. And if we didn't give you the authority here, you don't have the authority. We have misunderstood the way the Constitution was written, which is also why the debate even surrounding the Bill of Rights became a big deal in that era, where you had so many people saying, we don't have to have a Bill of Rights. The government can only do the specific things outlined in the Constitution, so it would be redundant to come back and say the people have the rights. Well, of course they have the rights, because we didn't give those rights or that power, the authority, to the federal government, but it made the people feel better to say—
Well, it makes me feel better because of the way they've changed the interpretation of
right.
things, which is, you know, President Biden has talked about, first, we nationalized all the student debt. People loaned money to students so they could go to school. The government took it over, and then willingly forgiving that debt,
yeah.
borrowing against, you know, against our grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren, paying off the debt of people who went to get their degree in college. This is nonsense.
Right. And to that end, it's worth noting that just maybe 2 weeks ago, whenever that was, I don't remember now, could have been longer, but there was that person on MSNBC who talked about that if you believe in God-given rights, you must be a Christian nationalist. And it's worth bringing up, right? Because nobody really knows how to define the term Christian nationalist, at least on the other side. They use it as an accusatory term to say you're really bad, you shouldn't do it. But if you believe in God-given rights, it makes you a Christian nationalist. That means every single founding father would have been a Christian nationalist.
All seven of them in your book?
Well, correct. All seven of those and every single one that signed the Declaration, everyone that did the Constitution, everyone that did the Bill of Rights. This was a general belief, and today we are seeing this weaponization again against people who believe gold and silver, right? Who believe gender, male and female, who believe in the Constitution, and we have to be smarter than that, stand up and defend our God-given rights, and try to return back to some of the advice, like from a George Washington, about how can America be successful? Go back and read his farewell address. It was brilliant, and those are things that can be recovered if people will relearn those lessons and work to apply them today.
Well, there's so much we can learn from history. People don't study it. I'm so grateful for Wall Builders because you bring history to life. You really genuinely do. I love every program that you produce. Love Rick Green, love your father, love
Thank
everything
you.
That you're doing is bringing the truth out. So we're going to take all this information and we're going to put it in an economic battle plan. And you get a copy free at economicwarroom.com. Remember, what we see is a marketplace our enemies view as a battle space. And that's in the political realm, the economic realm, and right here. This is Kevin Freeman from the Economic War Room.